Hi guys, Barry here. Just before you listen to this week's episode with our guest, QI elf Lauren Gilbert, where we talk about the world's worst astronomer, a quick hello to our newest Patreon donor. Thank you to Barry Carr. What an excellent name, Barry, who has donated a few quid to us each month and as such becomes a Patreoner and will be entitled to all of the bonus extra content we release on Patreon and early advance knowledge of live shows and sneak peeks at the book and all sorts of things like that. So thank you very much, Barry. We really appreciate it. If you want to be more Barry, and let's be honest, why wouldn't you? Then go to patreon.com/worstfootforward and chuck us a few quid. Help us keep the lights on here. Other than that, thanks to those of you who have been in touch with us via email with some facts and trivia as we collate our community 250th episode, which will be coming up in a month or two. If you want to share your favourite worst trivia, stories of failure, facts, and misadventure, then get in touch with us on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. We want to make an episode with your help to celebrate reaching the big 250. So yes, worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com to do that. You can always talk to us on the Discord, the link to which is in the description of this episode. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter as well, @worstfoot. Ben's on @BenVandeveld and I'm on @BazMaxDay. And I know a few of you still like to get in touch on Facebook as well. So you can just look for worstfootforward and we have a Facebook page. And everything to do with the podcast is on our website, worstfootforwardpodcast.com. Whew, that's a lot of admin that we have to do. But we've made it, folks. We got there in the end. So sit back, relax, and enjoy our show all about the world's worst astronomer. Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Barry Maxtay, and each week I, my co-host, and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. There's a star man waiting in the sky. Somebody help him! Somebody, please! And alongside me is the Ziggy to my Stardust, the Neil to my Armstrong, and the Black to my Hole. It's Ben Vandeveld.
Hello, I'm frankly staggered we're doing a show about the world's worst astronomer and you as an REM fan didn't make a Man in the Moon reference.
I was saving it.
Oh, fair. That's very fair. I am, as you beautifully demonstrated there, my favourite thing about the song Starman, which is from one of my absolute favourite albums in the world, is that it's basically the same melody as Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
And yes.
In many ways, many of the same sentiments.
If Bowie was still around, Elon Musk would be going, can we fire you into space, please? Like we've been doing with Shatner and people. All of these billionaires who are sending rockets to space would be dying to be the first one to get Bowie to do a concert from the moon.
Bowie would say, when I want to go into space, I will get there under my own means. Thank you very much, Mr. Yeah. Musk. Like, when I want to return home, I'll go home. The other thing is, like, you know that the Commander Chris...
Hadfield.
Thank you. Obviously recorded Space Odyssey aboard the International Space Station, not just with Bowie's blessing, but when Bowie heard it, he said, that is the definitive version of the song now.
I did say, if David Bowie was still around, we know that Bowie is still around within us and without us and around us forever.
I mean, you say that. I mean, obviously, you know, as we all know, he died in 2016 and then reality, as we know it, fell apart in every single direction. I don't think he's innocent around us, Barry. I think he has not just left the planet, he has left this dimension.
Yeah, little did we know that Bowie was the pillar holding up civilization as we know it.
Yeah, Bowie has now departed to the better timeline.
Yeah.
Talking of people who are very much holding up the better end of the bargain in this timeline, it's time to introduce this week's guest. She is a philanthropist, physicist, philosopher of politics, for the purposes of this intro, and phenomenally talented intellectual polyglot. She's a fellow at Open Philanthropy on the Global Health and Wellbeing Cause Prioritization Team, which investigates new areas to spread their benevolent wings. Prior to joining there, her PhD research focused on violence and how it influences the development of societies in which it occurs. She denies that this involves traveling the world armed with a boxing glove, a big stick, and a clipboard. Best of all for this show, she is a QI Elf, whose contributions have been commentated on by Neil Gaiman and Mark Hamill. Having found herself ennobled by two demigods of fantasy and sci-fi, she can now find herself here in the relative purgatory of our podcast. So it is a delight to welcome the fantastic, spelt with a PH, Lauren Gilbert.
Hello. That was slightly overselling my qualifications, but we'll go with it.
That is literally what we all spend our lives doing. That's what we work in entertainment in any way. I like that most of your qualifications tend to alliterate as well right at the start there.
Yes, I did get a degrees in political science and physics, so.
It's very satisfying. Your CV aligns very nicely. We have to mention, listeners may notice that this podcast is ever so slightly more truncated than others. And that's because Lauren is potentially one of the most on-brand guests for this show. She is coming to us all the way from the west coast of America. And we were due to be speaking to her at 8:30 a.m. her time. And we are. But guess what? That's earlier than we thought, because daylight savings happens 2 weeks earlier in America than it happens in this country. And for once, it's our guest that messed that up and not us. So...
Welcome to the podcast, he says, shoving you over the cliff.
Yeah. I mean, I have considered whether the thing I am worst at in the world is in fact time zones.
Yes, I would... I don't know. Would the world be simpler if we just all had the same time, but it was just dark at different times? Like, you know, 3 p.m. just means it's lovely and bright in the UK and it's pitch black in the Pacific.
Also, we should ban time zones that are half an hour off. Like,
oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. We're already, you know, putting in leap years and leap seconds and leap days and things like that to try and make up for how inaccurate everything is anyway. We don't need to be messing around with half-hour time zones. We get that the world is an approximation. Do they have them in America?
No, I had a call last week with some people in India, and it is 13 and a half hours off the West Coast.
Yeah, it's India, so I'm fairly certain either a bit of China or a bit of Myanmar has a quarter-hour time zone as well.
We've got more important things to worry about. Everyone synchronise watches now. Let's start the movement. On Worst Foot Forward, we're all synchronising watches right now on behalf of humanity.
Although, as the American here, I do have to, like, object to having a standardised unit system, because we're still out here using feet and inches. Yes. And what is a fluid out? I frankly don't even know.
We've discovered that, well, you're very good at making us react quickly to changing circumstances, I think is the polite way of putting it. What are you the worst at in the world, would you say, Lauren?
So I asked some of my friends this, and they were like, tact, anything that has ever crossed your mind comes out of your mouth. And it makes you very entertaining to be around, but also it's bad for you.
Has it ever gotten you into trouble?
Oh, about every other week.
Oh, no.
Is it that you're bad at tact, or is it that you're just very direct? Because one person's bad at tact is just another person's assertive.
Yes, but sometimes also it happens on Twitter.com, and there are things you should not say on the internet.
I mean, there's a lot of things that one shouldn't say on the internet, and it's amazing how many high-profile accounts insist on saying them.
Do you at any point ever have control of the QI Twitter account?
I have control over the QI Twitter account Tuesday through Thursday.
Tactless Tuesdays and Thursdays, we call them, I think, on the internet. We know friend of the show, Lydia Meisen, has also occasionally tweets on behalf of QI. She said she's had to occasionally retract or apologise for mistaken trivia and things. Is that something that's occurred to you?
The American spellings are what get me.
Oh, yeah.
I'm good at remembering to put U's in things, but I always spell everything I-Z-E, not I-S-E, and then everyone on the internet yells at me. QI is a British institution and should abide by the Queen's English, and why have we suddenly become American? It's not sudden. I have been American since 1990.
Is I-Z-E not also sort of... Is the Oxford English Dictionary not sort of going, well, both are acceptable?
I believe that both are acceptable, but not all of our Twitter followers seem to agree on this.
Okay. And they're all lexicographers.
Yeah. I have no problem with the Z. I think adding the Z to the middle of lots of common words gives them extra My brain has just come up with the word pizzazz, which I
literally
all says...
my brain did exactly the same thing.
Oh God! But it does. It just gives them a little bit of that.
There's a sense of danger when you stick a Z into a word. Let's be honest.
Yeah, there is, and it feels like there's a coiled spring in the middle of that word. Yeah. Which is what I like. Also, I do like the fact that you said that you have the QI Twitter account Tuesday through Thursday. I like that the QI Twitter account is given custody like the children of divorced parents.
Yes, generally the person who is tweeting that day is supposed to like monitor the replies and make sure that people are not screaming at us, or that the screaming is contained to the usual level of screaming that we're wrong, rather than like, we try to stay away from, say, current events, but because tweets are scheduled in advance, sometimes current events happen in the interim and we end up way more topical than we intended to be.
Oh no, so you have to clear up other people's mess sometimes.
Yeah. Yes. I had once tweeted about a church in Sri Lanka a few years ago had, instead of the hymn Hail Mary, a printed Tupac Shakur's Hail Mary lyrics in their booklet. And I had scheduled this innocently, like before I went to bed. And this went up the day of the Sri Lanka church bombings. And I was like, oh God. And I woke up to, you should not be commenting on this. If I had obviously posted that day, that would be incredibly insensitive to like mildly mock this Sri Lankan church. I have no idea if it was a church that was targeted or whatever, but it was completely coincidental.
What we've learned here, both through the recording of this podcast and that anecdote, that your timing is either terrible or brilliant. Yeah. And I can't work out which it is.
Whatever it is, it's half an hour behind. We are talking about the world's worst astronomer this week, which feels, when you get up to nearly 250 episodes of the show, it feels like a topic we should have done before, but apparently we haven't. So, Ben, you're the first up to the telescope. What do you see?
What I see, first of all, is Edward Pickering, who was a rather esteemed astronomer. In fact, he was director of the Harvard College Observatory. He is essentially astronomy's answer to the guy at Decca Records who, when confronted with the Beatles, said, "Bands with guitars are on their way out." He is the guy who said, the equivalent of the guy who said, "Oh yes, I'm sure that there will be an IBM computer in every town," because in an article in 1908 he said, "It is more than doubtful whether a further increase in the size of telescopes is a great advantage. It seems as if we had nearly reached the limit of size of telescopes, and as if we must hope for the next improvement in some other direction." Just as he was publishing this idea, the 60-inch telescope at Mount Wilson in Los Angeles saw first light and gathered some of the most incredibly productive astronomical data in history. Within another 9 years, there was a 100-inch telescope, and then within another 39 years, there was a 200-inch telescope in Mount Palomar, which remained the largest telescope until 1993. So, in terms of predicting the future, our friend Mr. Pickering was way out.
That's really great timing, that, as well.
Yeah, it is. Next, I looked at astronomers who basically got it wrong, who said that things were there and they weren't there. In 1991, an astronomer named Andrew Lynn from the University of Manchester in the United Kingdom announced the discovery of something apparently impossible: a planet orbiting a pulsar. Can either of you tell me why that is impossible?
I defer to the physics graduate.
I worked on cosmology, so astronomy is like...
Oh, you have the pained look of a university challenge contestant who knows that their team are expecting them to get this one. I'll put you out of your misery. It's because a pulsar is essentially the burnt-out husk of a star that has already exploded in a supernova.
So it's already destroyed all the planets around us.
Right, absolutely. It should not be there. What happened was that they checked and double-checked and triple-checked for mistakes, and they couldn't find any. However, 6 months after publishing the paper, he discovered that they had made one really crucial error, and that was that they forgot that the Earth's orbit isn't circular, it's elliptical. And when they made the correction for that, they discovered that this planet that shouldn't exist had disappeared. And so what he did, he stood up at a conference in Atlanta and admitted to a packed hall that he had screwed up. And in response, he got a standing ovation for it.
Having been to many astronomy conferences, I would also give that a standing ovation.
Yeah.
This is the thing. It's because, and you might be able to back me up on this, Lauren, that level of honourableness and good faith, it is often not apparent in academia and the scientific world. So the fact that he stood up and took his licks was pretty admirable.
That makes me think of Fred Hoyle, who was the early to mid 20th century astronomer. He was a big proponent of the steady state model, saying that the universe is basically the same size and will remain the same size. And then physicists began postulating that the universe was actually expanding as a result of what we call the Big Bang. And it was actually Hoyle that called the proposal the Big Bang. Initially, he coined the phrase as a kind of derogatory term, as it happens a lot with these derogatory terms, which was adopted by the people it was meant to be putting down. And he would just keep, you know, coming up with new explanations of why his theory didn't work, and he just kept moving the goalpost, basically trying to contrive ways in which the steady state universe would explain new observations. It's quite ironic that he just wouldn't admit his mistake, but he has left us that one phrase which everybody knows.
One of my friends who still works in theoretical physics has described his job as being wrong as quickly as possible.
I think that's now the job of the Tory party press office, isn't it?
Yeah. If I was part of a firm of lawyers, that's how I would answer it. Hello, Van der Velde and McStay, wrong as quickly as possible. A man who committed a similar mistake, but with considerably less honour, is the Dutch astronomer Peter van der Kamp. And he, in the 1960s, announced that he found evidence of a planet orbiting Barnard's star. And this went unquestioned until 1973, when it was debunked by another astronomer called George Gatwood. The reason he saw the planet was that it was a glitch caused when his telescope's lens was remounted. An honest mistake, but a bit sloppy, but he refused to renounce it. And he basically insisted all the way up to his death that that star was there. Basically, it was because of what was described as wobbles, thanks to the lens. And I suppose it's because he didn't want to admit that he'd been confounded by jelly, essentially.
The thing I really like about that is that, you know, in the 60s, someone going, I found a new planet, is huge news. Nowadays, we're like, yeah, mate, there's loads of them out there. Mm-hmm. nobody gives a shit. Come back to us when they're in the Goldilocks zone.
Exactly. Well, for a long time, people discovering potentially habitable planets didn't bother, because the way to spot whether a solar system has them, so I understand, is not searching for Earth-like planets first. It's searching for Jupiter-sized planets going around a sun, because they're much easier to spot. And you spot them, and then you go extrapolate going, oh, there might be an Earth-like planet there. But because people didn't bother doing that, it was forgotten for a long time. But for my choice, I've gone to our old friend, the Ig Nobel Prizes, because there are two Ig Nobel Prizes that have been awarded for astronomy. The first has been awarded to Jack Leo Van Imp, who was an American televangelist.
For fuck's sake.
Always turning out well.
Yeah, was he looking for angels and accidentally found some sort of new star?
You're not far off. What I particularly love about him is that him and his father both saw the light, and they used to spend the hours around the Van Imp living room washing over the tedium by playing the accordion together. And then after they saw the light, they would go around preaching the good book and playing accordion duets together, which sounds particularly hellish. Had memorized the King James version of the Bible, giving him the nickname the Walking Bible.
Sorry, I'm just imagining how great he and his dad are at parties.
Yeah. Yeah, just doing a polka version of the Bible accompanied by their accordion.
Next up, the Book of Joshua. And the one, and the two.
He won the Ig Nobel Prize because he discovered, along with his wife, Rex Seller, in inverted commas, that is, his wife isn't in inverted commas, his discovery is, that black holes fulfill all the technical requirements for the location of hell. When the prize was accepted on his behalf by MIT astrophysicist Walter Lewin, he described it as a breakthrough contribution to astrophysics. I'm saying that black holes now go beyond our wildest expectations, fantasies, and dreams. But to us as astrophysicists, they are heaven.
Okay, so we've been looking for hell the wrong place the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, what's happened is basically he's watched the movie Event Horizon and taken it a little bit too seriously.
But by that logic, sorry, just to extrapolate even further, surely that means everyone is eventually going to end up in hell because black holes are eating the universe.
Yeah, I'll be honest, Barry. I had a proper good search of the internet to see if I could find his working, and answer came there none, possibly because it's bullshit.
Yeah, well, okay, fine. That's always a possibility.
Yeah, a brief, very brief palate cleanser of my favourite other Ig Nobel Prize that I found this time, which is Patricia V. Agostino, Santiago A. Plano, and Diego A. Golombek won a prize for aviation for discovering that hamsters recover from jet lag more quickly when given Viagra.
Viagra actually has many uses. Apparently, it's also a cure for menstrual cramps.
Ah, what actual physiological effect does it have? Does it direct the blood away or to...
It's a vaso... I don't know if it's a vasodilator or a vasoconstrictor, but it, like, does the thing to make your uterus be less angry at you.
Ah, okay, that's the medical term.
Yes, as you can tell, I'm excellent at biology.
I have an angry uterus. Quoting Hippocrates there, I think.
Yeah. So my nominee is Richard C. Hoagland, who is an American author and a proponent of a lot of conspiracy theories, specifically about NASA and lost alien civilizations. Now, just to give him his full CV, he has no education beyond high school level, despite the fact that on his own CV, he says he is a curator of astronomy and space sciences at Springfield Science Museum, assistant director at Greengrass Science Center at West Hartford, Connecticut, and a science advisor to CBS News during the Apollo program. Now, I guess he was all of those things, but how he got there is beyond the ken of man. My favorite thing that he did before the claim that makes him my choice is that he, as an avid Star Trek fan, he lobbied President Gerald Ford to name the first space shuttle Enterprise, which it then was, knocking out the original very patriotic name of Constitution.
Yeah,
which I think we all agree is a better name.
I don't know, I think Enterprise is a better name, but I kind of like that. I kind of like that this Trekkie has just come along and gone, no, we're going to space, we gotta change the name.
Also, could there be anything more American than a space shuttle called Constitution?
Eagle Star Flag 1.
Yeah. He is the proponent of one of the most erroneous conspiracy theories. We've all heard of the man in the moon. He is the proponent of the face on Mars. There are pictures of rock formations on Mars that look like, frankly, they look like the mask from Halloween. It is purely a trick of the light when later, much more sophisticated cameras made passes of Mars in the 21st century. It was very clearly rock formations, but he wouldn't let this go. It's over a part of Mars called Cydonia, and he believed that they were evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence, that they showed pyramids and, in fact, a ruined city. And every astronomer or astrophysicist of note, from Carl Sagan on downwards, has dunked on him.
It's called pareidolia.
Yeah, where we see faces and things that aren't actually there. But my favourite debunking is this, that if you look for them, you can see faces anywhere and everywhere, especially on Mars. One example is the Gale Crater, which takes the form of a smiley, where there is another that resembles Kermit the Frog. And on this latter similarity, Discover
Magazine... It's not easy being red.
Yeah. which is, of course, what Joseph Stalin sang to himself whilst he swung back and forth. But on the Kermit the Frog likeness, Discover magazine's skeptical eye column ridiculed Hoagland's claims, asking if he believed that the aliens were fans of Sesame Street.
My other thing is, you mentioned Carl Sagan. Richard Hoagland claimed that he had created the Pioneer 10 plaque. You know, the plaque that we sent into space on the Pioneer probes. He said that it was his design along with a chap called Eric Burgess, something that even Burgess denies. the plaque was obviously designed by Carl Sagan and Linda Sagan and Frank Drake. But yeah, that's so... No, Sagan and Hoagland have beef already. And yeah, that beef has faces in it.
Yeah.
So I have a suggestion for the worst astronomer and also a suggestion of the most interesting astronomer in the spirit of QI.
Ah, great.
So my worst astronomer, and I am afraid I'm going to murder his name. I apologize. I am American. We cannot do French. Is something like... Guillaume de Le Gentil.
Guillaume Le Gentil.
Okay.
Which basically means William the Soft.
Yeah, William the Soft, William the Gentle.
French guy. I'm going to just go ahead and call him French guy because...
I reckon we go with Willy Soft from now on. Let's go with Willy Soft.
So he set off to see the 1761 transit of Venus. He made it all the way to India, but there was a war. So he couldn't get off the boat. So he's like, okay, I can see this. I'm going to watch it from my boat, but I can't take any measurements because the boat is moving around all the time. And so I can't take any measurements. This whole trip was wasted. But there's another transit of Venus that's happening pretty soon. By pretty soon, he means in 8 years. I will just stay in India for the next 8 years in order to see the next transit of Venus. So he does that, and he sends a letter to his wife and to the Royal Academy to be like, hey, I'm just going to stay for the next transit of Venus. Cool. Like, I'll see you in 8 years.
Can we just take a moment to wrap our heads around that as a notion that at a time when life expectancies were so much shorter than they are now, for him to just go, you know what? I'm going to pitch up for a good 15 to 20% of my days in a brand new country just to make sure I nail this little half hour sliver.
It's been a lovely marriage, but...
So he sticks around until 1769 and it's cloudy. So he gets no measurements of either transit of Venus that he traveled to India for and waited 8 years for.
Yeah.
He then goes back to France and is like, okay, so didn't get these measurements, but surely everything's okay here. Not so much. In the interim period, all of his letters had gone astray. He had been declared legally dead. His wife had remarried, and also his family had decided he was legally dead and then spent all his estate.
The Wikipedia article about it has the phrase, enthusiastically plundered his estate, as the description. Apparently none of his post had gotten home.
And really, I don't think you can be a worse astronomer than that. That
it's so good.
Not only did he not observe anything, he also, you know, got himself declared legally dead.
The other great thing about it is that obviously he was a French astronomer and the French wanted him to do this for France. And they were at war with France and Britain at the time during the Seven Years' War and so on. And instead of him seeing the transit of Venus, Captain Cook and his crew managed to do it from Tahiti in 1769. So the British beat him to that as well.
Love it. Is there any record of his diary from the day he was hoping to get the second transit of Venus and the clouds got in the way? Is it just the word mird 100 times?
I do want to give an honorable mention to Tycho Brahe, who you may have talked about in secondary school science, that he took really accurate measurements. He worked with Kepler. What they don't mention about him are some of the more interesting facts about him, that when he was in his 20s, he got into a duel about who was the best mathematician, and the person he was fighting with cut off part of his nose. So he wore a gold nose for special occasions for the rest of his life, just to show off the missing nose, apparently. He had a pet moose that he would bring around with him to visit his friends. At one point, he got the moose drunk, and the moose passed away after it drunkenly fell down some stairs at a party.
I mean, we shouldn't laugh, but Woody Allen could not come close to that situation. Was the moose trying to go downstairs or upstairs?
I believe downstairs.
To the cellar. I'll get us some more drinks, says the moose.
Yeah, well, obviously you've got to bear in mind that this was a moose in a heavily Catholic country, and inside the moose were two Jewish people who were like, we need to back out of here really quickly.
I also like the fact that he had the gold nose for special occasions, because you think if people have heard of Tycho Brahe, they imagine the golden nose, but that was like his occasional nose.
No, he had a brass one for every day, and then a silver one and a gold one for special occasions.
Yeah.
Oh my God, imagine going like, today's a special day, I'm putting on my golden nose. Or I like the thought of kind of like a Renaissance monarch writing in the diary going, I feel snubbed by Brahe, he only turned up in his bronze nose.
Tycho, you could have dressed for the occasion.
Yeah.
If his moose's death wasn't enough, his own death was mysterious. There were rumors that Kepler might have killed him for his scientific notes. He kept them really secret, and Kepler wanted his observations. But based on exhumations, it appears that he died because he was at a party and refused to leave to go pee and developed a bladder infection.
So he died because, as a remarkably talented and far-thinking astronomer, he had the constitution of a toddler.
Correct. There were rumors at the time that surely he must have been murdered because, like, that's a ridiculous way to die.
He's literally taking the piss.
Yeah. No, he was literally withholding the piss.
Yes.
Since you mentioned Tycho Brahe, do either of you know about one of his compatriots, Giordano Bruno?
No.
I do not.
Oh, so I'm all over this stuff. I studied both of them for my degree, because I did the scientific movement in the 17th century, and they sort of kick it off. So he was one of these classic Renaissance men. He was a friar, philosopher, mathematician, poet, hermetic occultist and cosmological theorist. And I mean,
okay, the last couple I'm gonna,
the last couple means that he's on the guest list for Neil Gaiman and Amanda Palmer's dinner parties. And he held a lot of controversial views at the time. In particular, his cosmology was not approved of by the church, who obviously would go on to be fairly unpleasant towards his successor, Galileo. He had a notion of an infinite universe, good, that was filled with a substance called ether, kind of went on to sort of influence people later on. But the big thing that he said that they didn't like is that there are worlds other than our own that have no less virtue, nor a nature different from that of our Earth, and that, like the Earth, they contain animals and inhabitants. So he was a guy in the 1570s and 80s positing the notion of aliens, and the Catholic Church went, absolutely not, get on that stake and don't come off till you're done.
Oh no.
Yeah. Some of his thinking have been said to be a predecessor of the many worlds interpretation put forward by Hugh Everett III, who is the sort of the godfather of multidimensional thinking, and also the actual father of the lead singer of the Eels. And he also was a pantheist. You know, he saw God in everything, which, again, lovely idea. Not if you want to live in times of Catholicism. But yeah. I love the idea that a guy was going, you know, smoking a fat Renaissance dube and going, dude, what about aliens? And the Pope at the time was just like, no, what about not?
Yeah. Do you know the theory that Tycho Brahe may have inspired Hamlet?
Yes. So he may or may not have been having an affair with the Queen of Denmark. And he was hanging out a lot in Wittenberg.
Yeah. He also, two of the characters in Hamlet, obviously, are Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Apparently, Brahe has ancestors with the names Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Oh, that's great. Wouldn't it have been great if he had been nailed down as an inspiration for Hamlet? And it was Shakespearean orthodoxy that the actor playing Hamlet had to wear a gold, silver, or bronze nose. And you just know that, like, Olivier was like, I'm going to go method, and he chops his own nose off.
Yeah. Apparently the Danish also use the expression Tycho Brahe day if it's an unlucky day.
Oh.
Yeah, I think it's possibly because he was a bit superstitious. It's, if you're having a particularly bad day, you've had a Tycho Brahe day. Your elk has fallen downstairs.
Yeah, I like the thought of, like, how you doing, Barry? My elk has fallen down the stairs.
Yeah.
What people also don't know about Tycho Brahe is that he also had a nose made of straw, a nose made of wood, and a nose made of bricks.
Anytime he blew his nose, yeah. Two-thirds of the time it would fall down.
My friend who is a Shakespeare scholar is going to listen to this and email me in great detail about the many ways I am wrong.
Hamlet studied at Wittenberg, which is where you mentioned as well. So yeah, you're you know, we're not QI. We're not going to klaxon you on our podcast.
Oh, I like the thought that. But poor Lauren, she's like a terrified variable in an experiment. Who's your man who does the buzzers and the electrical currents?
Milgram. Stanley Milgram.
That is how the panelists on QI feel about the klaxon.
Yeah. Well, no, but it's just that they just get the klaxon, whereas I assume the QI elves have actual electrical currents run through their bodies. John Lloyd sort of treats the QI elves like a six-year-old treats a hamster. Oh, well, another one on the slab.
Yeah. I get off lightly by being American. It's too much trouble to wire me up all the way over here.
One last thing about Tycho Brahe, I really like. He inherited an awful lot of money on the death of it. I think he was sort of raised by an uncle, but his dad was also very wealthy. His inheritance was something like 1% of the GDP of Denmark.
Which he spent all of on astronomy.
He spent every bit of it on astronomy, yeah. He built his own observatory. He had a paper mill, which he watermarked. He put all his research on it. Yeah, he was a very wealthy guy.
I can't get over this nose. Now that I know that they were gold and silver and bronze, I feel like he'd have made them into some sort of nasal astrolabe. Or
that's a perfectly normal phrase you're expected to say when you woke up this morning, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That's my capture test to prove that I'm not a robot and that reality isn't a simulation. If that can occur naturally and organically, then we're all okay.
Yeah. Very good. All right, so much and all as we love and are interested by Tycho Brahe, you're putting forward Guillaume Le Gentil, or Gentle Willy, Soft Willy, as the worst astronomer.
Yes.
Before we started recording, I mentioned that it was quite hard to find bad female astronomers, because the few names that come up, all very impressive. Was it you mentioned Edward Pickering earlier, Ben?
Mm-hmm.
A guy called Charles Young, who was an astronomer at Princeton, wrote a letter to Edward Pickering in 1905 about a woman called Henrietta Swan Leavitt, and he dubbed her a variable star fiend. She worked at the observatory at Harvard and was eventually promoted. She began investigating variable stars, stars whose light emissions rise and fall for various different reasons. And by 1905, so within 3 years, she had added more than 1,000 entries to a roster of known variable stars. She was just discovering them at about a rate of one a day. And she particularly focused a lot of her energy on a category called Cepheids. And she discovered what she termed a remarkable relation. The period of a Cepheid's brightening-dimming cycle closely correlates with its average brightness. That's the longer the period of a Cepheid, the more luminous it is. And she proposed that you could calibrate this in such a way that it would help you figure out how far away Cepheids were, and that of the distance of its host star cluster or galaxy. So she was able to come up with a method that actually helped you measure how far away star clusters and galaxies were, which was groundbreaking at the start of the 20th century. I also quite liked reading about a chap called Asaph Hall, who was determined to find the Martian moons. And Hall was at one point, he was a carpenter's apprentice, he was an architect, but then he discovered the joys of astronomy, married his former mathematics instructor, Angeline Stickney. Hall eventually went on to work at the observatory in Washington, D.C., and he was searching desperately, like a lot of people were at the time, for the Martian moons. They were posited, but no one had actually observed them before. And he came home one night in August 1877, saying, "I've been looking for months, haven't been able to find." They had a brand new 26-inch refractor telescope. It was the highest quality telescope in the world. No one can find one of these. And it was his wife, Angeline, who insisted he get back to work immediately. And in the early hours of the 12th of August, 1877, he indeed spotted Deimos, asteroid-sized moon.
I believe that validates her.
Yeah, absolutely. And four nights later, he spotted Phobos as well, and he was acclaimed worldwide. And since then, a pair of craters on Phobos have been named Hall and Stickney in honour of the astronomer and indeed his mathematically gifted wife.
Oh, lovely. I thought you were going to say they're going to be named Hall and Oates.
Yeah. Obviously, you know who came up with the idea of the sun being the centre of the solar system and the Earth orbiting it.
This feels like I'm about to have an electric current pass through my system. It was Kepler, wasn't it?
Yeah, Copernicus. You've all avoided saying Copernicus.
Yeah.
But Copernicus is the one who we sort of say, oh, is the man who came up with the heliocentric idea of the solar system. But he was doing it about 1800 years after a Greek geometer, to give him his job title, called Aristarchus.
We should bring back the title of geometer. Like, that's a
geometer
really
good... is a good title, yeah. He was a contemporary of Archimedes, and it's largely through Archimedes that we know that Aristarchus basically put forward the idea that the sun was the center of our solar system and the Earth orbited. And not only that, but he said that the Earth was spinning, and that was how he accounted for the rising and the setting of the sun. And now his fellow philosophers and contemporaries of the time would have said either he was a radical thinker or a heretic. And there was definitely at least one tract at the time denouncing him for impiety.
Wow.
It didn't really take off as an idea.
It does feel like a lot of science, particularly stuff like physics and astronomy. There are a number of ancient Greeks who will have been slapping their heads going, if only you'd listened to us, we sussed this out 2,000 yeah. years ago.
If our paper was slightly more durable.
But also notions that the Earth is flat. Flat Earthers hate you pointing out a number of things to them, not least that their entire worldview is bullshit. But people didn't really believe the world was flat. Like, again, the Greeks had sussed out that it was spheres 2,500 years ago. Otherwise, none of their maths would work.
Yeah, otherwise, they wouldn't have had geometers. Now, one more pair of astronomers I really liked are Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson. And they, in the 1960s, were part of a group of people who were trying to study cosmic radio waves. That in the 40s, you had people like George Gamow and Ralph Ader and Robert Herman predicting that if the universe had originated with a Big Bang, then there must be remnants of that energy infusing all of space, this cosmic microwave background. And so in the 60s, you have Penzias and Wilson at the Bell Labs in Holmdel, New Jersey. They decided they were going to entirely repurpose the facility's satellite communications antenna and try and study cosmic radio waves. And they had this big antenna, it was 20 feet long. It looked like an oversized ear trumpet, basically. And it was steerable. So you were able to be, the idea would be that you could be able to capture and measure microwave energy from any direction you pointed it in.
Yeah, small point of order that once you fitted your nasal astrolabe, you have to get an oversized ear trumpet to go with it. It's the next part of the Sonos system.
Yeah. But before they could say that any of the data that they'd collected was reliable, they needed to identify and mathematically account for all potential interference. So any terrestrial sources, microwave transmission towers, radiation from Manhattan, the sun, the energetic core of the galaxy, they were having to basically go through a checklist of all of the possible interference before they could go, this thing that we're measuring, this line on the graph, this is the cosmic radio energy. They spent a year trying to clear their airwaves, and the antenna was still catching up this persistent low-level noise coming from all directions around. And they were constantly going, okay, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. They even at one point had to rule out the idea that it was heat emissions from bird droppings on the inside of the antenna.
So they got out there in the middle of the antenna with, like, brooms and started brushing away at the crusted bird guano.
Yeah, it's literally they had to go, it's not this. And eventually they're like, the only thing it can now be, we've accounted for literally everything, is this cosmic microwave background. And so they won the Nobel Prize in 1978 for their achievement.
So my friend Emily Petrov works at a telescope in Australia, or she was working there at the time. And they had these weird detections that were happening when they were looking at fast radio bursts. And she was like, okay, what's going on? They published a couple of papers being like, there's this weird thing going on. Like, we don't know what's physically causing this. Maybe it's a new particle. It turns out that they were opening the microwave door before the microwave had gone off, and the telescope was picking up the microwave emissions.
Brilliant minds.
And then they didn't want it to ding, so they were opening the door just before it dinged, and that screwed up their observations.
That is amazing. Yeah, you should never open your microwave before it dings, and never pour your tea before your kettle is properly boiled.
I believe her now best cited paper is about, actually, this is just the microwave.
as a lesson to other research scientists everywhere. I looked up the phrase bad astronomer, and there is a guy called Philip Carey Platt who calls himself the bad astronomer. He's a skeptic and a popular science blogger. He's worked on the Hubble Space Telescope. He works on public outreach for NASA and so on. And he's been posting on the internet for nearly 30 years, eventually in 1998 establishing badastronomy.com with the goal to clear up public misconceptions about astronomy and debunking hoaxes and writing about critically analysing pseudoscience and things like that. He's written about the Planet X. He's written a lot about Richard Hoagland's theories, about the moon landing hoax, in inverted commas. He's written a book called The Bad Astronomer, one section of which I really like, part 4, Artificial Intelligence, where he attempts to take down various conspiracy theories, like young earth creationism, all those sort of things. One of the things in this chapter in his book, Artificial Intelligence, he has a section called Appalled at Apollo, and it's devoted to the moon landing hoax, conspiracy theories, all of those things. And he compares various different arguments that moon landing hoaxers make against basic laws of physics. And one of the biggest targets he took aim at, he became quite famous for criticizing a Fox Network special in 2001 called Conspiracy Theory, Did We Land on the Moon? Hosted by an actor called Mitch Pileggi, who appeared in The X-Files. And one of the prominent figures who appeared on this program was my nominee for the World's Worst Astronomer, a guy called Bill Kaysing. Now, Bill Kaysing, he claimed that the 6 Apollo moon landings between 69 and 72 were all hoaxes, and he is basically the founding father of moon landing conspiracy theorists. The problem, in many ways, for Kaysing is that he did kind of work a bit around the whole space adventure. He'd been a salesman, an insurance claims examiner, and a cabinet maker, and then he found work as a technical writer at Rocketdyne's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a division of North American Aviation in the 50s, around the same time leading up to the development of the Apollo missions. And he worked there till the 60s, resigned in 1963 for personal reasons. In the mid-70s, he began writing about his much earlier time. Like I said, he resigned in 1963 before man had gotten anywhere near the moon. And he said in the early 60s that at his time at Rocketdyne, he was privy to documents about Mercury, Gemini, Atlas, and the Apollo programs that NASA was running, and arguing one did not need an engineering or science degree, for engineering or science degrees he had none, to determine that a hoax was being perpetrated. So he said that because he worked in publishing at this jet propulsion lab, he had seen things which he knew that meant man had not landed on the moon 6 years after he had last worked for this company. He said maybe there was enough technology to send a crewed rocket to the moon, but definitely not enough technology to bring him back. He said there's no way of traveling through the atmospheric radiation without harming the astronauts. Even before July 69, he said he just had a hunch and intuition and a true conviction, and he just would not believe anyone was going to go to the moon. He was one of those people who the conspiracy theory had embedded itself so far into his brain that he would refuse to believe any evidence to the contrary. And so in 1976, he self-published the book We Never Went to the Moon, America's $30 Billion Swindle. And in it, you have a lot of the arguments you get against the moon landing, NASA didn't have the technical expertise to do it. There's no stars in the photographs. There are unexplained optical anomalies, like the wave in the flag, the way the shadows are. There's an absence of blast craters beneath the lunar modules. All of these things. He also went on in his later career to say that NASA had staged the Apollo 1 fire and the Space Shuttle Challenger accident to deliberately murder the astronauts on board because they were all about to expose NASA.
Oh, what I mean, as really unpleasant conspiracies go, that is upping the ante quite remarkably.
I remember it being mentioned on QI. If we had faked the moon landings, that's a lot of people to have to murder, because a lot of people would have to keep their mouths shut about it being a hoax.
Physicists have modeled how long it would take for it to come out if the moon landing was a hoax. Different models give different numbers, but it's somewhere like 6 months to a couple of years. There's no chance that you could get that many people to keep their mouths shut for that long.
The thing is, if it was the Russians that had got to the moon first or had faked the moon landings, and you're like, you're going to have to kill a lot of people to keep this quiet. Completely believable.
Also, keeping our mouths shut is not like one of my country's strength.
So I'm sort of going to use some of Platt's arguments to talk about some of Kaysing's, to debunk some of Kaysing's ideas. One of the things is, you know, he mentions, why aren't there blast craters beneath the lunar module? Why hasn't it left an enormous dust cloud and huge, like, indentations on the surface of the moon? And he's right, you know, if the lunar module was traveling at the top speed it can reach, then of course it would have left big dents on the surface of the moon. And the short answer was, they slowed it down. Of course it's not going at top speed. That it was built to be able to land softly so it wouldn't break the moon or itself.
That would be an amazing bit of fakery if the Eagle lands on the moon and just a fissure goes all the way down the surface of the moon as the papier-mâché breaks apart.
Okay, so you have a future in science fiction filmmaking. Yeah.
He says there's no stars in the photo. There are, they're just dim.
Very much like the maker of the theory.
Yeah, and also the moon's atmosphere is different to the Earth's atmosphere, so the way light is refracted through it is different to how we would see things down here. The wave in the flag is quite a popular one. Kaysing says there has to have been a breeze on the set where this was being filmed, and that there wouldn't be a flag wave in a vacuum, which is absolute bollocks. Of course flags can wave in vacuums. You can impart force onto things physically as opposed to with wind. The way the flag worked that they brought to the moon with them, it's mounted on the side of a pole and with a little telescopic horizontal bar. So you actually pull the bar out horizontally from the long vertical bit, and apparently there was a slight stick in it, so the wave that there is in it is literally because it isn't fully extended. They think that actually the astronauts kind of wanted it to look that way. They thought it would have looked a bit crap if it was flat, so they just left a little wave in it because it looks nice. Also, some people would go on to point out, if the flag is blowing in a breeze, why don't we see loads of dust blowing around too? If they've gone to the trouble of building a very dusty set, why isn't there dust blowing around in this magical breeze? And my favourite one is this Fox programme, which Kaysing appears on, says that there was a movie called Capricorn 1 about how NASA must have faked a Mars expedition. And the programme points out that the Apollo footage from the surface of the moon is strikingly similar to scenes in Capricorn 1, which is quite a good argument. You go, okay, if they've made this movie, it's not an amazing coincidence. The film Capricorn 1 was made in 1978. The coincidence is probably that the makers of Capricorn 1 were copying the moon landing.
No, the coincidence is that the makers of Capricorn 1 are time travellers. They're time travelling conspiracy theorists.
Because he is the grandpappy of the worst of conspiracy theories, and the conspiracy theory that sort of is it's the gateway drug conspiracy theory to lots of the other conspiracy theories that we now have to contend with in modern life, I'm going to say that Bill Kaysing is my nominee for the world's worst astronomer.
I do want to add my favorite QI style fact about the moon landings.
Yes, please.
One of the last astronauts to go up got to the moon and discovered he was allergic to moon dust. So had like horrible hay fever the entire time he was on the moon.
Who was that?
I believe that was Herschenschmidt. It's gonna suck so much to be like, I am one of the like 15 people that has ever gone to the moon and I am allergic to it.
We've all had days like holidays we've been really looking forward to, and then we get terrible like food poisoning or sunstroke or something like that, and it feels worse because you've been looking forward to the holiday for so long and now it's been ruined. he's been training to go to the moon for years. Then his hay fever kicks in. Although, hang on, do we know if he was lactose intolerant? Maybe if the moon is made of cheese, that's what we discovered.
Do you know what the first food and drink consumed on the moon was?
I know there was a lot of applesauce. They used to get little tubes of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, the clue is in me asking what was the first food and drink, because it came as a pair, and it's because it was communion wine and a wafer. Because I think Buzz Aldrin took communion on the moon.
Oh, wow.
I mean, what a move. Like, thank you, God, for all of this science that's got me here.
Yeah. When the guys were going to the moon, the Apollo 11 astronauts, they obviously, lots of people had died in the testing process leading up to Apollo 11. Basically impossible for them to get life insurance. So they just signed loads of memorabilia before they left.
Huh.
And gave it to their families and friends. So they said, if I die, this is going to be worth quite a lot. I mean, as they lived, it's probably worth a fair bit as well. But if they had died going to the moon, they're like, this is your insurance policy.
In fairness to the Vatican, after the, you know, centuries of persecuting astronomers, they have come around to, like, space being cool. They have, like, good observatories now and they run conferences.
Do they?
Yeah. Like, they employ professional astronomers. They run astronomy conferences. It's a thing.
I mean, to be fair, if they're looking at all of God's creation, they've been focused on one blue and green marble for quite a long time. It's about time they broadened their view.
God did a good job on it, I feel like.
God, A plus for God on that exam. So our candidates this week for the world's worst astronomer are Ben's suggestion of Richard Hoagland, the man who won an Ig Nobel Prize for staring at the face of Mars. Lauren's suggestion of Guillaume Le Gentil, or Soft Willy, the man who travelled across the world to try and spot the transit of Venus and missed it twice. And my suggestion of Bill Kaysing, the man who bequeathed us the moon landing conspiracy. I have to say, I also was gonna pick Guillaume Le Gentil. There's just so many bits of his story that I really enjoyed. That storms delayed him, that the war with Britain and delayed him getting out of France in the first place. They spent 5 weeks lost at sea. When they got to India, the British occupied Pondicherry, so they were told to go back again. There was so many things that just stopped them being able to do what he wanted to do. And the translation of his name. And then the cherry on top of the fact that his wife had remarried when he got back. So I think it's going to have to be a win for Lauren and for Guillaume Gentil. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the best news of the week, which comes from the Animal Kingdom this week. Ben and long-time listeners will know that I wrote a play about a bat a few years ago. Big fan of bats generally, and there's more than 1,300 bat species on the planet. And they've just found one that they thought was extinct. Hill's horseshoe bat was thought to have gone extinct about 40 years ago. Apparently, they have been rediscovered in a forest in Rwanda. They've been described as looking quite comical. They've got the very big ears, but also, you look at their face and it's quite hard to pick out the eyes and the nose and the mouth. It's a sort of a big soft horseshoe looking thing. When they found it, Bat Conservation International said, we knew immediately the bat we had captured was unusual and remarkable. The facial features were exaggerated to the point of comical. Horseshoe bats are easily distinguishable from other bats by characteristic horseshoe shape and specialised skin flaps on their nose. They did some measurements on it and then they released it back into the wild, of course. But it was only when they came back to Europe that Dr. John Flanders, then visiting museum archives to compare the known specimens from the past to what they had seen in Africa, that they were actually able to confirm that this was the first sighting of a Hill's horseshoe bat in 40 years.
This wasn't just him taking the Hill's horseshoe bat and comparing it to every single specimen in the museum.
I think they had a suspicion that this is what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And they took lots of measurements and photos and all of that. And it was, but they were only absolutely certain when they went back and looked at the same measurements and images. So yeah, they
wonder if bats come home and like have an alien abduction story about being captured by scientists that I was caught up in this net and they did these horrible medical procedures to me.
You won't believe.
We are the spawn of bat conspiracy theories.
I've seen things, man. I've seen things. Giant bats without much hair wearing white, towering over me, 6 foot tall. All right. Before we go, Lauren, where can people find out more about you and your work if they would wish to do so?
I am not an astronomer on Twitter, where I am frequently forgetting that my boss follows me on Twitter. So I am entertaining in generally ill-advised ways.
Very good. Not an astronomer. So you weren't even qualified to be in the running for today's title.
When I worked in astro, I was very clear that I was an astrophysicist, not an astronomer. This is a distinction that only astrophysicists care about.
Yeah. Well, we're all going to see if we can find a face in the surface of Ben. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
That's only if my children face plant into my muffin tops.